when we were served a lavish meal, including out-of-season mangoes, I noticed that my brother-in-law's appetite was meager. He was bewildered, diving deep into the ocean of thought. On the return journey to Calcutta, Satish, with softened expression, occasionally glanced at me pleadingly. But he did not speak a single word after the moment the priest had appeared to invite us to lunch, as though in direct answer to Satish's challenge. The following afternoon I visited my sister at her home. She greeted me affectionately. "Dear brother," she cried, "what a miracle. Last evening my husband wept openly before me. Beloved Devi," he said, "I am happy beyond expression that this reforming scheme of your brother's has wrought a transformation. I am going to undo every wrong I have done you. From tonight we will use our large bedroom only as a place of worship. Your small meditation room shall be changed into our sleeping quarters. I am sincerely sorry that I have ridiculed your brother. For the shameful way I have been acting, I will punish myself by not talking to Mukunda until I have progressed in the spiritual path. Deeply I will seek the Divine Mother from now on. Someday I must surely find her." Years later, I visited my brother-in-law in Delhi. I was overjoyed to perceive that he had developed highly in self-realization, and had been blessed by the vision of Divine Mother. During my stay with him, I noticed that Satish secretly spent the greater part of every night in divine meditation, though he was suffering from a serious ailment, and was engaged during the day at his office. The thought came to me that my brother-in-law's lifespan would not be a long one. Roma must have read my mind. "Dear brother," she said, "I am well, and my husband is sick. Nevertheless, I want you to know that, as a devoted Hindu wife, I am going to be the first one to die. It won't be long now before I pass on." Taken aback at her ominous words, I yet realized their sting of truth. I was in America when my sister died, about a year after her prediction. My youngest brother Bhishan later gave me the details. Roma and Satish were in Calcutta at the time of her death. Bhishan told me, that morning she dressed herself in her bridal finery. "Why this special costume?" Satish inquired. "This is my last day of service to you on earth," Roma replied. A short time later she had a heart attack. As her son was rushing out for aid, she said, "Son, do not leave me. It is no use, I shall be gone before a doctor could arrive." 10 minutes later, holding the feet of her husband in reverence, Roma consciously left her body, happily and without suffering. Satish became very reclusive after his wife's death, Bhishan continued. "One day he and I were looking at a large smiling photograph of Roma. 'Why do you smile?' Satish suddenly exclaimed, as though his wife were present. 'You think you were clever in arranging to go before me. I shall prove that you cannot long remain away from me, soon I shall join you.'" Although at this time Satish had fully recovered from his sickness, and was enjoying excellent health, he died without apparent cause shortly after his strange remark before the photograph. Thus prophetically passed my dearly beloved eldest sister Roma, and her husband Satish, he who changed Atdakshin's war from an ordinary worldly man to a silent saint. Chapter 23. I receive my university degree. You ignore your textbook assignments in philosophy. No doubt you are depending on an unlaborious intuition to get you through the examinations. But unless you apply yourself in a more scholarly manner, I shall see to it that you don't pass this course." Professor D.C. Goshal of Saranpur College was addressing me sternly. If I failed to pass his final written classroom test, I would be ineligible to take the conclusive examinations. These are formulated by the faculty of Calcutta University, which numbers Saranpur College among its affiliated branches. A student in Indian universities who is unsuccessful in one subject in the AB finals must be examined anew in all his subjects the following year. My instructors at Saranpur College usually treated me with kindness, not untinged by an amused tolerance. "Mukunda is a bit overdrunk with religion." Thus summing me up, they tactfully spared me the embarrassment of answering classroom questions. They trusted the final written tests to eliminate me from the list of AB candidates. The judgment passed by my fellow students was expressed in their nickname for me, Mad Monk. I took an ingenious step to nullify Professor Goschel's threat to me of failure in philosophy. When the results of the final tests were about to be publicly announced, I asked a classmate to accompany me to the professor's study. "Come along, I want to witness," I told my companion. "I shall be very much disappointed if I have not succeeded in 221, outwitting the instructor." Professor Goschel shook his head after I had inquired what rating he had given my paper. "You are not among those who have passed," he said in triumph. He hunted through a large pile on his desk. "Your paper isn't here at all. You have failed, in any case, through non-appearance at the examination." I chuckled. "Sir, I was there. May I look through the stack myself?" The professor, nonplussed, gave his permission. I quickly found my paper, where I had carefully omitted any identification mark except my roll call number. Unwarned by the red flag of my name, the instructor had given a high rating to my answers even though they were unembellished by textbook quotations. Seeing through my trick, he now thundered, "Sheer brazen luck." He added hopefully, "You are sure to fail in the AB finals." For the tests in my other subjects, I received some coaching, particularly from my dear friend and cousin, Prabhas Chandra Ghose, I son of my uncle Sarada. I staggered painfully but successfully with the lowest possible passing marks through all my final tests. Now, after 4 years of college, I was eligible to sit for the AB examinations. Nevertheless, I hardly expected to avail myself of the privilege. The Serampore College finals were child's play compared to the stiff ones which would be set by Calcutta University for the AB degree. My almost daily visits to Sri Yukteswar had left me little time to enter the college halls. Then it was my presence rather than my absence that brought forth ejaculations of amazement from my classmates. My customary routine was to set out on my bicycle about 9:30 in the morning. In one hand I would carry an offering for my guru, a few flowers from the garden of my Panthar boarding house. Greeting me affably, master would invite me to lunch. I invariably accepted with alacrity, glad to banish the thought of college for the day. After hours with Sri Yukteswar, listening to his incomparable flow of wisdom, or helping with ashram duties, I would reluctantly depart around midnight for the Panthai. Occasionally I stayed all night with my guru, so happily engrossed in his conversation that I scarcely noticed when darkness changed into dawn. One night about 11 o'clock, as I was putting on my shoes in preparation for the ride to the boarding house, master questioned me gravely. "When do your AB examinations start?"
"5 days hence, sir.
I hope you are in readiness for them." Transfixed with alarm, I held one shoe in the air.
"Sir," I protested, "you know how my days have been passed with you rather than with the professors. How can I enact a fuss by appearing for those difficult finals?"
Sri Yukteswar's eyes were turned piercingly on mine. "You must appear." His tone was coldly peremptory. "We should not give cause for your father and other relatives to criticize your preference for ashram life. Just promise me that you will be present for the examinations, answer them the best way you can." Uncontrollable tears were coursing down my face. I felt that master's command was unreasonable, and that his interest was, to say the least, belated.
"I will appear if you wish it," I said amidst sobs.
"But no time remains for proper preparation." Under my breath I muttered, "I will fill up the sheets with your teachings in answer to the questions." When I entered the hermitage the following day at my usual hour, I presented my bouquet with a certain mournful solemnity. Sri Yukteswar laughed at my woebegone air. "Mukunda, has the Lord ever failed you, at an examination or elsewhere?"
"No, sir," I responded warmly. Grateful memories came in a revivifying flood.
"Not laziness but burning zeal for God has prevented you from seeking college honors," my guru said kindly. After a silence, he quoted, "Seek ye first the kingdom of God, and his righteousness, and all these things shall be added unto you." For the thousandth time, I felt my burdens lifted in master's presence.
When we had finished our early lunch, he suggested that I return to the Panthai. Does your friend, Ramesh Chandra Dutt, still live in your boarding house? Yes, sir. Get in touch with him. The Lord will inspire him to help you with the examinations. Very well, sir, but Ramesh is unusually busy. He is the honor man in our class, and carries a heavier course than the others. Master waved aside my objections. Ramesh will find time for you. Now go. I bicycled back to the Panthai. The first person I met in the boarding house compound was the scholarly Ramesh. As though his days were quite free, he obligingly agreed to my diffident request. Of course, I am at your service. He spent several hours of that afternoon and of succeeding days in coaching me in my various subjects. I believe many questions in English literature will be centered in the root of Childe Harold, he told me. We must get an atlas at once. I hastened to the home of my uncle Sarada and borrowed an atlas. Ramesh marked the European map at the places visited by Byron's romantic traveller. A few classmates had gathered around to listen to the tutoring. Ramesh is advising you wrongly, one of them commented to me at the end of a session. Usually only 50% of the questions are about the books, the other half will involve the author's lives. When I sat for the examination in English literature the following day, my first glance at the questions caused tears of gratitude to pour forth, wetting my paper. The classroom monitor came to my desk and made a sympathetic inquiry. My guru foretold that Ramesh would help me, I explained. Look, the very questions dictated to me by Ramesh are here on the examination sheet. Fortunately for me, there are very few questions this year on English authors, whose lives are wrapped in deep mystery so far as I am concerned. My boarding house was in an uproar when I returned. The boys who had been ridiculing Ramesh's method of coaching looked at me in awe, almost deafening me with congratulations. During the week of the examinations, I spent many hours with Ramesh, who formulated questions that he thought were likely to be set by the professors. Day by day, Ramesh's questions appeared in almost the same form on the examination sheets. The news was widely circulated in the college that something resembling a miracle was occurring, and that success seemed probable for the absent-minded mad monk. I made no attempt to hide the facts of the case. The local professors were powerless to alter the questions, which had been arranged by Calcutta University. Thinking over the examination in English literature, I realized one morning that I had made a serious error. One section of the questions had been divided into two parts of A or B, and C or D. Instead of answering one question from each part, I had carelessly answered both questions in Group I, and had failed to consider anything in Group 2. The best mark I could score in that paper would be 33, 3 less than the passing mark of 36. I rushed to Master and poured out my troubles. Sir, I have made an unpardonable blunder. I don't deserve the divine blessings through Ramesh. I am quite unworthy. Cheer up, Mukunda. Sri Yukteswar's tones were light and unconcerned. He pointed to the blue vault of the heavens. It is more possible for the sun and moon to interchange their positions in space than it is for you to fail in getting your degree. I left the hermitage in a more tranquil mood, though it seemed mathematically inconceivable that I could pass. I looked once or twice apprehensively into the sky. The Lord of Day appeared to be securely anchored in his customary orbit. As I reached the Panthai, I overheard a classmate's remark, "I have just learned that this year, for the first time, the required passing mark in English literature has been lowered." I entered the boy's room with such speed that he looked up in alarm. I questioned him eagerly. "Long-haired monk," he said laughingly, "why this sudden interest in scholastic matters? Why cry in the 11th hour? But it is true that the passing mark has just been lowered to 33 points." A few joyous leaps took me into my own room, where I sank to my knees and praised the mathematical perfections of my divine father. Every day I thrilled with the consciousness of a spiritual presence that I clearly felt to be guiding me through Ramesh. A significant incident occurred in connection with the examination in Bengali. Ramesh, who had touched little on that subject, called me back one morning as I was leaving the boarding house on my way to the examination hall. "There is Ramesh shouting for you," a classmate said to me impatiently. "Don't return, we shall be late at the hall." Ignoring the advice, I ran back to the house. The Bengali examination is usually easily passed by our Bengali boys, Ramesh told me. But I have just had a hunch that this year the professors have planned to massacre the students by asking questions from our ancient literature. My friend then briefly outlined two stories from the life of Vidyasagar, a renowned philanthropist. I thanked Ramesh and quickly bicycled to the college hall. The examination sheet in Bengali proved to contain two parts. The first instruction was, "Write two instances of the charities of Vidyasagar." As I transferred to the paper the lore that I had so recently acquired, I whispered a few words of thanksgiving that I had heeded Ramesh's last-minute summons. Had I been ignorant of Vidyasagar's benefactions to my university degree, mankind, including ultimately myself, I could not have passed the Bengali examination. Failing in one subject, I would have been forced to stand examination anew in all subjects the following year. Such a prospect was understandably abhorrent. The second instruction on the sheet read, "Write an essay in Bengali on the life of the man who has most inspired you." Gentle reader, I need not inform you what man I chose for my theme. As I covered page after page with praise of my guru, I smiled to realize that my muttered prediction was coming true. "I will fill up the sheets with your teachings." I had not felt inclined to question Ramesh about my course in philosophy. Trusting my long training under Sri Yukteswar, I safely disregarded the textbook explanations. The highest mark given to any of my papers was the one in philosophy. My score in all other subjects was just barely within the passing mark. It is a pleasure to record that my unselfish friend Ramesh received his own degree cum laude. Father was wreathed in smiles at my graduation. "I hardly thought you would pass, Mukunda," he confessed. "You spend so much time with your guru." Master had indeed correctly detected the unspoken criticism of my father. For years I had been uncertain that I would ever see the day when an AB would follow my name. I seldom use the title without reflecting that it was a divine gift, conferred on me for reasons somewhat obscure. Occasionally I hear college men remark that very little of their crammed knowledge remained with them after graduation. That admission consoles me a bit for my undoubted academic deficiencies. On the day I received my degree from Calcutta University, I knelt at my guru's feet and thanked him for all the blessings flowing from his life into mine. "Get up, Mukunda," he said indulgently. "The Lord simply found it more convenient to make you a graduate than to rearrange the sun and moon." Chapter 24. I become a monk of the Swami Order. Master, my father has been anxious for me to accept an executive position with the Bengal Nagpur Railway, but I have definitely refused it. I added hopefully, "Sir, will you not make me a monk of the Swami Order?" I looked pleadingly at my guru. During preceding years, in order to test the depth of my determination, he had refused this same request. Today, however, he smiled graciously. "Very well, tomorrow I will initiate you into Swamiship." He went on quietly, "I am happy that you have persisted in your desire to be a monk." Lahiri Mahasaya often said, "If you don't invite God to be your summer guest, he won't come in the winter of your life." Dear Master, I could never falter in my goal to belong to the Swami Order like your revered self. I smiled at him with measureless affection. "He that is unmarried careth for the things that belong to the Lord, how he may please the Lord, but he that is married careth for the things of the world, how he may please his wife." I had analyzed the lives of many of my friends who, after undergoing certain spiritual discipline, had then married. Launched on the sea of worldly responsibilities, they had forgotten their resolutions to meditate deeply. To allot God a secondary place in life was, to me, inconceivable. Though he is the sole owner of the cosmos, silently showering us with gifts from life to life, one thing yet remains which he does not own, and which each human heart is empowered to withhold or bestow: man's love. The Creator, in taking infinite pains to shroud with mystery his presence in every atom of creation, could have had but one motive, a sensitive desire that men seek him only through free will. With what velvet glove of every humility has he not covered the iron hand of omnipotence? The following day was one of the most memorable in my life. It was a sunny Thursday, I remember, in July, 1914, a few weeks after my graduation from college. On the inner balcony of his Serampore Hermitage, Master dipped a new piece of white silk into a dye of ochre, the traditional color of the Swami order. After the cloth had dried, my guru draped it around me as a renunciate's robe. "Someday you will go to the West, where silk is preferred," he said. "As a symbol, I have chosen for you this silk material instead of the customary cotton. In India, where monks embrace the ideal of poverty, a silk-clad Swami is an unusual sight. Many yogis, however, wear garments of silk, which preserves certain subtle bodily currents better than cotton." "I am averse to ceremonies," Sri Yukteswar remarked. "I will make you a Swami in the Bidwat, non-ceremonious manner. The Bibhidhisu or elaborate initiation into Swamiship includes a fire ceremony, during which symbolical funeral rites are performed. The physical body of the disciple is represented as dead, cremated in the flame of wisdom. The newly made Swami is then given a chant, such as, 'This Atma is Brahma or Thou art that or I am He.'" Sri Yukteswar, however, with his love of simplicity, dispensed with all formal rites and merely asked me to select a new name. "I will give you the privilege of choosing it yourself," he said, smiling. "Yogananda," I replied, after a moment's thought. "The name literally means bliss, Ananda, through divine union yoga." "Be it so. Forsaking your family name of Mukundalal Ghosh, henceforth you shall be called Yogananda of the Giri branch of the Swami order." As I knelt before Sri Yukteswar, and for the first time heard him pronounce my new name, my heart overflowed with gratitude. How lovingly and tirelessly had he labored, that the boy Mukunda be someday transformed into the monk Yogananda. I joyfully sang a few verses from the long Sanskrit chant of Lord Shankara: "Mind, nor intellect, nor ego, feeling, sky nor earth nor metals am I. I am He, I am He. Blessed spirit, I am He. No birth, no death, no caste have I, father, mother, have I none. I am He, I am He, blessed spirit, I am He. Beyond the flights of fancy, formless am I, permeating the limbs of all life, bondage I do not fear, I am free, ever free. I am He, blessed spirit, I am He." Every Swami belongs to the ancient monastic order which was organized in its present form by Shankara. Because it is a formal order, with an unbroken line of saintly representatives serving as active leaders, no man can give himself the title of Swami. He rightfully receives it only from another Swami. All monks thus trace their spiritual lineage to one common guru, Lord Shankara. By vows of poverty, chastity, and obedience to the spiritual teacher, many Catholic Christian monastic orders resemble the order of Swamis. In addition to his new name, usually ending in Ananda, the Swami takes a title which indicates his formal connection with one of the 10 subdivisions of the Swami order. These Dasanamis or 10 agnomens include the Giri mountain, to which Sri Yukteswar, and hence myself, belong. Among the other branches are the Sagar, Sea, Bharati, Land, Aranya Forest, Puri, Tract, Tirtha, Place of Pilgrimage, and Saraswati, Wisdom of Nature. The new name received by a Swami thus has a twofold significance, and represents the attainment of supreme bliss Ananda, through some divine quality or state: love, wisdom, devotion, service, yoga, through harmony with nature, as expressed in her infinite vastness of oceans, mountains, skies. The ideal of selfless service to all mankind, and of renunciation of personal ties and ambitions, leads the majority of Swamis to engage actively in humanitarian and educational work in India, or occasionally in foreign lands. Ignoring all prejudices of caste, creed, class, color, sex, or race, A Swami follows the precepts of human brotherhood. His goal is absolute unity with spirit, imbuing his waking and sleeping consciousness with the thought, I am he. He roams contentedly, in the world but not of it. Thus only may he justify his title of Swami, one who seeks to achieve union with the Swa-self. It is needless to add that not all formally titled Swamis are equally successful in reaching their high goal. Sri Yukteswar was both a Swami and a Yogi. A Swami, formerly a monk by virtue of his connection with the ancient order, is not always a Yogi. Anyone who practices a scientific technique of God contact is a Yogi. He may be either married or unmarried, either a worldly man or one of formal religious ties. A Swami may conceivably follow only the path of dry reasoning, of cold renunciation, but a yogi engages himself in a definite, step-by-step procedure by which the body and mind are disciplined, and the soul liberated. Taking nothing for granted on emotional grounds, or by faith, a yogi practices a thoroughly tested series of exercises which were first mapped out by the early rishis. Yoga has produced, in every age of India, men who became truly free, truly yogi Christs. Like any other science, yoga is applicable to people of every clime and time. The theory advanced by certain, by B.K. Maitreu in Kalyana Kalpataru, the Lord in his aspect as Shiva, not a historical personage like Krishna, Shiva is the name given to God in the last aspect of his threefold nature, creator, preserver, destroyer. Shiva, the annihilator of Maya or delusion, is symbolically represented in the scriptures as the Lord of renunciates, the king of yogis. In Hindu art he is always shown with the new moon in his hair, and wearing a garland of hooded snakes, ancient emblem of evil overcome and perfect wisdom. The single eye of omniscience is open on his forehead. I join the Swami order. Ignorant writers that yoga is unsuitable for Westerners is wholly false, and has lamentably prevented many sincere students from seeking its manifold blessings. Yoga is a method for restraining the natural turbulence of thoughts, which otherwise impartially prevent all men, of all lands, from glimpsing their true nature of spirit. Yoga cannot know a barrier of east and west any more than does the healing and equitable light of the sun. So long as man possesses a mind with its restless thoughts, so long will there be a universal need for yoga or control. The ancient Rishi Patanjali defines yoga as control of the fluctuations of the mind's tough. His very short and masterly expositions, the Yoga Sutras, form one of the six systems of Hindu philosophy. In contradistinction to Western philosophies, all six Hindu systems embody not only theoretical but practical teachings. In addition to every conceivable ontological inquiry, the six systems formulate six definite disciplines aimed at the permanent removal of suffering and the attainment of timeless bliss. The common thread linking all six systems is the declaration that no true freedom for man is possible without knowledge of the ultimate reality. The later Upanishads uphold the Yoga Sutras, among the six systems, as containing the most efficacious methods for achieving direct perception of truth. Through the practical techniques of yoga, man leaves behind forever the barren realms of speculation and cognizes in experience the veritable essence. The yoga system as outlined by Patanjali is known as the Eightfold Path. The first steps, 1, Yama, and 2, Niyama, require observance of 10 negative and positive moralities, avoidance of injury to others, of untruthfulness, of stealing, of incontinence, of gift receiving, which brings obligations, and purity of body and mind, contentment, self-discipline, study, and devotion to God. The next steps are, 3, Asana, right posture, the spinal column must be held straight, and the body firm in a comfortable position for meditation, 4, Pranayama, control of prana, subtle life currents, and, 5, Pratyahara, withdrawal of the senses from external objects. The last steps are forms of yoga proper, 6, Dharana, concentration, holding the mind to one thought, 7, Dhyana, meditation, and, 8, Samadhi, superconscious perception. This is the Eightfold Path of Yoga, which leads one to the final goal of Kaivalya, absoluteness, a term which might be more comprehensibly put as realization of the truth beyond all intellectual apprehension. Which is greater, one may ask, a Swami or a Yogi? If and when final oneness with God is achieved, the distinctions of the various paths disappear.